played it, there was no music.
Yeah, he was quiet.
There were two clear tracks
but
overlapping
each
other.
But I do kind of remember him being intriguing.
And I also remember the day the police searched the stream for him. I was there. I watched them do it.
To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour.
That's my wife Carol reading the first four lines of The Auguries of Innocence by the 19th century poet William Blake, a man who claimed to experience divine visions throughout his life. When he was 10 years old, he claimed to see a tree filled with angels, bright angelic wings, bespangling every bough like stars. A recitation of that very same poem was uncovered from a mysterious vinyl record I inherited from Alistair Glamis, who disappeared 20 years ago. So how did I figure out the author of the words? A simple online search revealed their origin. But now, thanks to my friend Ricky Rawls, I also now know who spoke them. You are listening to the Disappearance Podcast, Episode 2, The Omen. The Auguries of Innocence was written in 1803, but it wasn't published until after William Blake's death some 60 years later. It was taken from one of Blake's notebooks, now known as the Pickering Manuscript. The year Blake wrote the poem, he was involved in a fistfight with a soldier named John Schofield. I'm mentioning it because it was interesting. Blake was charged with assault. He was also charged with declaring treasonable words against King George III. Schofield claimed that during their fight, Blake exclaimed, "Damn the king. The soldiers are all slaves. I'm from a land of free minds, and someday I shall return to it." He was later cleared of the charges. So again, the origin of the words was clear, but the speaker was a mystery. Until I presented Alistair Glamis's recording to my oldest friend, Ricky Rawls, he recognized the voice immediately.
"You've done it, man. You've captured the voice of a ghost. It's old Sam Glamis."
"Sam Glamis?"
"Yeah. Alistair Glamis's father."
"Are you sure it's him?"
"It's been a while, but I'm positive. He died a year ago, but I bumped into him at the country store a bunch of times over the years. I heard his voice enough. I wouldn't forget a voice like that."
"What else do you know about Alistair's father?"
"I don't know much, but he was a local character, if ever there was one. And he carried..."
"Carried what?"
"A firearm. Always with a gun."
While it makes sense that Alistair's recording would be of his father, it's still unclear why the recording is presented in such a strange way, and ultimately, why it was given to me. If Sam Glamis's reading of the poem wasn't strange enough, it appears that there is something even stranger about the recording than what I had initially noticed. There is a couplet in the excerpt that I played during my last episode that doesn't appear in the original poem. I'm going to replay it now. Listen closely.
"A robin redbreast in a cage, a tall heaven in a rage, a dove house filled with doves and pigeons shuttles hell through all eternities. A dog starved at his master's gate with its ruin of the state. Watch the eagle take life, strike the mirror with the knife."
That part is the strange part. "Watch the eagle who will take life. Strike the mirror with the knife." That is not in any version of the poem that I can find. My study of the poem turned up some other things too. For one, the title, The Auguries of Innocence. I didn't know what an augury was. Now I do. The term refers to an omen, an event or happening taken as a sign of something yet to come. It can be a warning about the future. The original concept comes from ancient Rome and involves an interpreter, an augur, gaining understanding of the future by studying the flights of birds. The poem itself deals with a series of what appears to be paradoxes. For example, how can one hold infinity in the palm of one's hand when infinity, by definition, has no boundaries? The poem also deals with the paradoxes of human nature. As Blake writes, "Man was made for joy and woe. Then when this we rightly know, through the world we safely go. Joy and woe are woven fine, a clothing for the soul to bind." Is it possible that Sam Glamis had a rare copy of the poem with additional lines? Why wouldn't that version of the poem be online? Everything is online. Also, I can't help but think that the words themselves sound more like an omen than any other part of the poem. Watch the eagle who'll take life. Strike the mirror with the knife. As I told you in my first episode, a second vocal track was uncovered from the same album side. This track was presented backwards and layered over the Blake poem recitation. The voice uncovered was the same voice, presumably that of Sam Glamis, Alistair's father. But this time it wasn't William Blake being recited. It was another William, specifically William Shakespeare. I'm now going to play an excerpt of that track. Listen closely.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in mystery pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow of war player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of scorn and fury, signifying nothing.
You don't have to look it up. I looked it up for you. The words are from Macbeth, which I'm a little nervous about saying out loud. There is an old superstition that says that the three witches depicted within that play cast real spells in Shakespeare's lines that express themselves as curses upon whomever speaks the name Macbeth inside a theater. Isn't a podcast like this considered theater of the mind? The candor of the words spoken by Sam Glamis are just like the words of William Blake, recited almost like a spell. But the words themselves are not from the witches. They're from one of the most famous speeches within the play, that of Act 5, Scene 5, when Macbeth is reacting to the news of his wife's death by apparent suicide. As both tracks prove to be literary in nature, I decided to contact a local expert. Well, she's actually my wife's friend, Julie Allegost. She's an English teacher at the local high school. You've already heard from her husband, Tom Allegost, who's helping me with the podcast. Julie listened to my first episode as well as the recordings. She agreed to help me make sense of it. I sat down with her 2 days ago, expecting to learn a little about Shakespeare. What I didn't expect was for her to blindside me with a revelation.
This is one of Shakespeare's most inspiring passages. He's speaking directly to artists and writers. At each phrase of it, it's been taken and reused. For example, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. It's a short story by Kurt Vonnegut. Signifying nothing, short story by David Foster Wallace. Even the two words, out, out, it's the title of a poem by Robert Frost.
He repeats this passage over and over again in the recording, but I don't know why.
I think the more revealing question is, why Macbeth? I listened to the first episode of your show, and something struck me immediately.
What was it?
His name. The boy who disappeared is named Alistair Glamis. You must have read Macbeth in high school. Well, in the play, Macbeth resides at Glam's castle. He was the Thane of Glam's. The witches first address Macbeth before telling him of his future by saying, "All hail, Macbeth! Hail to thee, Thane of Glam's!" And that word, Glam's, it's spelled G-L-A-M-I-S.
Glamis.
That's right. Your friend's name is connected to one of the most famous castles in Scotland.
Glam's castle is not only one of the most famous castles in Scotland. There are many who refer to it as Scotland's most haunted castle. Its story is riddled with murder and intrigue. And there isn't just one tale to inspire the haunting, but many. I collected a list. The family chapel is thought to be haunted by a gray lady. The spirit of Lady Janet Douglas burned at the stake as a witch in 1537. In another story, a badly treated servant from 200 years ago, a young boy, is said to haunt a stone seat by the door of the queen's bedroom. In yet another story, the ghost of a woman with no tongue is supposed to haunt the castle grounds. Witnesses even describe a woman running, pointing at her mutilated face. And most disturbing, in my opinion, are the stories surrounding the monster of Glam's, thought to be the deformed son of the 11th Earl, raised to adulthood, locked in a secret room. While some have reported his ghost, others say the boy lived for over 100 years despite his mistreatment and isolation inside the castle walls. I know this all sounds like fiction, and it might be, but I encourage you to look up these stories. Some of them are more bizarre than how I've presented them.
Lover, your love is like pure danger. Your heart is the dark stranger, asking for a
After our conversation ended, Julie referred me to one of her friends. His name is Bodhipaksha, which is Sanskrit, by the way. He's a local writer. He's also a meditation leader. Julie has attended some of his classes. While he lives in New Hampshire, the first thing you may notice is that Bodhi was actually born in Scotland. Julie said that he had a passion for history and might have something to say about Glam's castle. It turns out he did.
I was actually born only about 12 miles away from Glam's in Dundee. My whole family is from that area. I actually moved away when I was quite young, but we used to go back there every weekend and visit my grandparents. And my granddad used to tell me this story about Glam's castle. It was about an Earl of Glam's known as Earl Beardy. And the story goes that he was a compulsive gambler, also a drunk and generally a bit of a scoundrel. So he would want to play cards every evening and get drunk. And one night, you know, he was in his usual state of, you know, desperately wanting someone to play a game of cards with him, but no one would do it because it was the Sabbath night. And he uttered the fateful words that he would play cards even with the devil himself. And there was a knock on the door, and a tall, handsome, mysterious gentleman in a long coat asked if the Earl was up for having a visitor to play cards with. And so the Earl and this mysterious stranger ended up locked in a closed room playing late into the night. And at some point, the servants got worried and they could hear a drunken yelling coming from the room. And one of them looked through the keyhole and instantly was struck blind in that eye. So the Earl heard the commotion from the servants outside, who were, of course, deeply upset about what was going on. So he opened the door to find out what was going on, and when he turned back into the room again, the mysterious stranger had disappeared, and the Earl's soul had gone with him. And the legend goes that Earl Beardy is still playing cards somewhere in the castle, trying to win his soul back from the devil.
Bodhi was right. That was the most intriguing story to come out of Glom's castle. With my head full of ghost stories, I turned back to that small copper key that fell out of Alistair's mystery box. I contacted a locksmith named Teddy Tornberg. If you're local, then I want to note that she is the daughter of the original Ted Tornberg Locksmith Company founder, who is sort of infamous in this area. He has a bunch of funny commercials. The company also drives around in vans that have been modified to look like gigantic locks. It's pretty cool. I asked Teddy to take a look. She confirmed what I had was indeed some kind of skeleton key. But she also shared this.
The idea that a skeleton key can open up any kind of lock is a myth. This is just a master key designed to open a certain type of lock.
What's the difference between a master key and a skeleton key?
Not much. It's just terminology. Back in the day, cabinetry all came with the same sort of lock. That's not what this is. If this opened up a post office box, and I imagine that that was the type of lock it was designed to open, you shouldn't expect to be able to open anything else.
So do you think this might have been a postmaster's key?
Could be. If you take a close look, someone has grounded out the middle of the key so it won't trigger anything. This looks like a homemade job. I'm not an expert, but I kind of remember hearing that opening up someone else's mail is a federal offense. I wouldn't advise visiting post offices with this key if I were you.
In going over all the strange stuff Alistair left behind, I can't help but reflect on the fact that I barely knew him before he disappeared. This isn't a case of some kid leaving something behind to his best friend. Ricky is and will always be my best friend. If Ricky disappeared, then this would be a different story. Alistair is and remains a big question mark in my past. I know so little about him. Maybe that's why I can't stop thinking about him.
Are you sure you weren't friends? Like, maybe you had one special conversation together and that he internalized that as friendship?
That's my wife, Carol.
And he wanted you to have these things. The record, the key. Maybe it's because of something you said back when you were in class together.
I barely remember that class.
What class was it?
It was physics. I don't even remember the teacher's name.
Mr. Pratt. I had him too. He was the guy that always talked about the Appalachian Trail.
Oh yeah. He hiked it before becoming a teacher, that's right. I completely forgot.
You should look him up. He's probably still a teacher. Maybe he'll remember something you don't.
Something about a kid in his class from 20 years ago? A kid that he only had for a few months at the end of a school year?
Hey, this is your project, but it seems like you should be exploring every lead that you can find.
Carol was right, and as it turned out, Mr. Pratt was easy to find. I found his full name in Carol's yearbook, Zachary Pratt. A quick search online revealed that he's no longer a teacher, but the new superintendent in a Western Massachusetts school district. I called, hoping it was him, and lo and behold, it was. He agreed to be recorded for an interview. Let's just say he remembered much more than I expected. I now know how the mysterious vinyl record came to be made, and I'll play that interview for you during my next episode. In the meantime, if you know anything and wish to share, or if you want to explore a video about the ghosts of Glam's castle, or if you want to support Bodhipaksha's new meditation app, or maybe you want to find links to the musicians who've contributed to the project, then please visit me at disappearancepodcast.com or like the show on Facebook. Thanks to Ricky Rawls, Julie Allegost, Teddy Tornberg, Bodhipaksha, and my wife Carol for making this episode possible. Thanks also to Prom Queen, Ross Boyd, Rudy Sims for providing the music. Thanks also to Ryan Fitton, Jillian Thiel, Jen Whitley, and Larry Doyle for the support. Let's talk soon. Partners in Crime Media.